This episode of Forensic Forecast is brought to you by Digital Forensics Magazine at www.digitalforensicsmagazine.com and by contributions by our listeners. Thank you all very much. Hello, welcome to another episode of Forensic Forecast. And seeing as we were overwhelmingly encouraged by the by everybody's response last time we did a panel, we've decided that that's what we're going to do from now on. Unfortunately, Simon is no longer going to be on Forensic Forecast, and it's a long story. I'm not going to get into it, but needless to say, we have more than adequate replacements. Once again, we're joined by Eric Huber. How are you doing, Eric?
Hello. Great. Thanks for having me on again.
Oh, fantastic. Sounds a lot better this time around.
Yeah. Yay, Skype.
And also joining us again is Tom. How are you doing?
Good. Thanks again for having me on.
Excellent stuff. Always a pleasure to have you. And joining us also is Martin Fisher from Southern Fried Security. How are you doing, Martin?
Fantastically.
Good stuff. Martin's been trying to get on Forensic Forecast for quite a while. Every time I ask for volunteers, he's always the first person to respond.
You're my hero, Lee. You know, it's just, you know, it's the
I'm someone's hero. Well, there's the stuff of nightmares. All right, fantastic. Well, got a few stories to talk about this week, and I thought that we got to start with the big story, the major story, and that is, what the hell are Gizmodo and Apple doing? This is quite a remarkable story. Gizmodo, quote unquote, acquired the new Apple iPhone, a phone they thought was the Apple iPhone 4G, and as it they put videos up on the website and all kinds of stuff, and Apple were like, no, it's not ours, not ours, nope, not ours at all. And then all of a sudden they said, yep, it's ours, can we have it back, please? So Gizmodo, having paid $5,000 for the phone from wherever they got it from, went and sent it back, I believe. But then the next thing that you know, Mr. Chen, who is the editor at Gizmodo, had his door kicked in by the police, and they wandered off with all of his computers and servers and all the fun things that a geek techie editor is going to have in his home. What on earth is going on here?
But this is Eric. I mean, this is a great story. I've been following it all week. I don't know what on earth they were thinking. Once Apple figured out, and it's interesting, I'm not sure why they denied it at first. Maybe they didn't believe it that this had happened. But once they figured out that, oh, hey, that's our stuff, Steve Jobs practically did his Samuel Jackson from Pulp Fiction imitation, or, halfway expected him to call up Gizmodo and ask them, do you read the Bible, Gizmodo, before striking them down with great vengeance and furious anger. The best thing that I figured is, it's like an old joke, engineer walks into a bar with a new iPhone. And, depending on how you read it, what seems to be clear is the engineer leaves the bar and this other fellow acquires the iPhone. And instead of turning it over to the bar or calling the police or anything like that, what's he do? Well, of course, he ends up selling it to Gizmodo for $5,000. And what I read, he may have actually talked to somebody else who may have acted as an intermediary. But now, of course, he's claiming, gosh, Gizmodo said it would be okay for me to give them. It would be perfectly fine to share them. It's like, okay, I'll go to them for legal counsel. So what I've read in the article is, Apple went to their outside counsel, and they're a very sharp law firm. I know of them, Melbourne and Meyer. And O'Melveny called a prosecutor in California, and then the prosecutor in California, I'm not sure which one, got the REACT team involved. And for those of you who are forensicators, and hopefully we probably have some members of that team who are listening to Forensic Forecast, they're a very experienced, well-established bunch of forensicators in that area. And, they got the call, so they did what you would expect them to do, which is, okay, we have a theft, and it's ended up at these folks are at this this fellow's house, and they did a search warrant. And I'm not sure. I'm a former police officer, but I never served in California, so I don't know what the laws are for theft and conspiracy. But I'm sure we're going to find out pretty soon. And the Gawker Media, and they own Gizmodo, are trying to claim apparently some sort of journalistic shield laws involved here. And that's the other wonderful part of the story, which is it kind of illustrates the decline of American journalistic integrity, because this is, classic checkbook journalism, which, when you go to journalism school, you're not supposed to do. But of course, all the networks here in the U.S. basically do it. They don't pay for interviews, but they, with a wink and a nod, they pay for the rights to the photographs and that sort of thing. So, yeah, there's a lot of different things in here. So it's going to be very interesting to see, are criminal charges filed? Does this go to a grand jury? Is Apple going to file some sort of civil suit, or is this going to go away? So we'll see. But it's been an interesting story to follow.
Yeah, we've been following it ourselves, and it's interesting. There's been a lot of conversation out with the Twitterati about people trying to defend Gizmodo, and I look at it this way. The San Mateo County District Attorney received pretty open evidence that under California law, the crime, the felony of theft and sale of stolen property had occurred. I mean, Gizmodo pretty much basically came out and said, we paid $5,000 for this. And people are just agitated that, my co-host, Severin Fried, was really animated about, here's just Apple going after somebody again. And I look at it more from a law enforcement perspective of, these guys copped to committing a felony. Now, whether or not you like the way that felony statute is drawn up in California is neither here nor there. They copped to all the elements of that felony, and they're shocked when law enforcement steps in. And it boggles my mind that people want to defend Gizmodo here. Was it a great article? Sure. I thought it was really interesting, but the way they got that phone was just, I can't believe they did that.
Well, and of course, what's the interesting part of this as well, too, is the fact that it's, there's two aspects. One, it's the, potentially the new iPhone. And two, it's Apple has a history of being able to keep things under wraps. And this sort of slip up is, I think, a bigger aspect of, the shining castle, so to speak, suddenly has, a dirty spot on the wall. And all of a sudden you can see into it or something like that.
Oh, it's like the chink in Steve Jobs' armor, isn't it?
Right. The perfect record has now been shattered, so to speak. The one aspect I thought was funny is the Dilbert cartoon that came out a couple of days ago.
Fantastic.
That was just classic.
But I think if you want to look at Apple and where Apple just looks bad, is I think a better example is the Woz put out that picture where, Woz got a look at the iPad, a couple minutes before it was released, and, he had to put his hands on it for 2 minutes prior to it becoming generally available, and the engineer who let him do that got fired. I see that, if you want to pick on Apple as being, maybe losing control of, of their famous secrecy and all, that's probably a better example than, engineer goes to a bar and loses a camouflaged, new version of the iPhone.
Yeah, I saw that article too, and I thought that was a bigger kind of, okay, it's if it was an engineer showing it to someone who wasn't Steve Woz, then okay, maybe you can understand why the person would get fired. But I mean, technically, isn't Steve Woz still an Apple employee, even though he's no longer physically with the company?
Yeah, I think he still is an employee, but he's not within that group anymore. But, I mean, really, without him, there wouldn't have been Apple.
Well, you're talking 2 minutes. What possible thing is going to happen, giving it to him, of all people, 2 minutes before it goes on sale. It's not like people don't know about the product already. It's not like people aren't getting it in their hands any sooner.
Well, yeah, I mean, go on.
No. Just, you know, what damage is being done versus the person who, you know, I mean, how many people have lost cell phones in a bar? I mean, provided this is probably not one you'd want to be taking out anyway at this point, but, you know, it's, I think the whole thing is getting more blown out of proportion because of what it was that was essentially stolen, found, and lost and found, or what have you. I think parts of it have been overkill and more publicity oriented in terms of, you know, if the Gizmodo people gave the phone back to Apple, why the big sense show in busting into the guy's house?
Well, the reason is because this isn't an ordinary cell phone. This is Apple's, you know, intellectual property, in that this is their new product that they want to release. If it was just, you know, this engineer's personal cell phone, you know, their act team isn't going to spend a lot of time doing a search warrant on that. Who knows if they'd even take the case? But this is different because this is, you know, one of the primary employers and the primary businesses in that area, essentially having their secret sauce stolen and then not only stolen, but then broadcast out to everyone else. So that's why it's a higher profile deal, because it's not just any cell phone. And it seems to me it's a pretty classic theft case. You know, I'm not sure what sort of defense you're going to have. You have that guy in the bar who walked away with property that he reasonably should have known wasn't his, and then you have the Gizmodo people purchasing the property, which, you know, they know certainly isn't theirs, and then you know, acting surprised when you know, Apple sends the hounds of hell after them.
So there's no differentiation.
What's interesting though is why didn't Apple try to suppress any of the publishing of the information?
Well, did they know about it before Gizmodo published it?
But even after they published it, they, you know what I'm saying? Why didn't they try to suppress it? I mean, obviously you couldn't. Once it's out there, but
well, yeah.
There didn't seem to be any moves to, you know, everyone else started picking it up.
I mean, really, what could they have done? I mean, anything they would have done along those lines, I think, would have simply called more attention to it. And I think that, you know, the classic public relations stance would be ignore it until it goes away.
Yeah, the Barbara Streisand effect.
I got a question, because I don't really know how the law would work in the States regarding this. So if some guy just found this in a bar, and, you know, is it still considered theft or trading in stolen property if it was just left behind and not actually taken from somebody?
Yeah, the way Steve Reagan had talked to some attorneys in California, the way the law is written in California is that if you find property that you reasonably believe belongs to someone, that you can identify who it belongs to, and then you do not get it back to them and you sell it, you are guilty of theft.
Okay.
And then the person who bought it, if they know the same thing, if they know that this is not they should reasonably have known that you weren't the legitimate owner, they're then potentially guilty of receiving stolen property.
I thought the guy tried to try to contact Apple, and they never. They talked to somebody, and they just kind of brushed him aside. I thought that was one of the initial.
Well, I mean, there's a lot of different. I've heard a couple different things along those lines. It'll be interesting to see how it all eventually pans out. But to me, if I put on my investigator/prosecutor hat, that simply goes to prove that he knew who it really belonged to.
Yeah, and I think the React team, my guess is what they're going to be doing is forensicating all the stuff that they have once they give the authorization to do that, to put together one kind of a timeline of events to see if that meets the elements that they have to prove. And then two, I'm sure they're looking for communications between Gizmodo and whoever else, because that will help determine, you know, the state of mind as far as, you know, are they saying, hey, this is your stolen stuff? In fact, and Martin, maybe you know this, I thought there was one of the letters or one of the responses from Gizmodo to Apple basically said, hey, we've got your stolen cell phone.
Yeah, that's that I think that's a reasonable interpretation of it. And then for me, the other interesting thing, and this is if you really want to sit down and talk about it for hours, talk with Steve Reagan about the whole, you know, Shield law. I mean, Nick Denton about a year and a half ago explicitly said in an interview that Gawker Media is not journalism. They may accidentally do journalism, but that's not what they're there for. So the journalism Shield law, which only would protect them from a search warrant, not from a criminal subpoena, is almost a moot point. So I think at this point, if I was, you know, Gawker Media, I would be really, really worried right now that my guys may go to jail. And if I'm Apple, I'm just glad I got my stuff back and I was able to brick it quickly.
The thing I find the most interesting about this, and this is because I brought this up on Twitter a few days ago, and Rob Lee said, well, yeah, Gizmodo acted irresponsibly. And I agree. But who comes out looking like a winner in this case?
I don't think anybody does.
Yeah. I can't see how this makes Apple look any better. I can't see how it makes Gizmodo look any better.
No.
Well, I mean, here's the thing. Let's look at it this way. Let's say, you know, this was a similar thing where Intel, this is kind of far-fetched, but, you know, an Intel engineer sitting in a bar with, you know, one of the new i7 chips before it's announced. Yeah. And leaves it in the bar, and that gets found, and the whole thing plays out. You'd expect them to do the same thing.
It'll have a deterrent effect. I assume that's probably one of Apple's strategy, which is, all right, we're willing to be a little more louder about this than we might normally do, just to have a deterrent effect and to show people that we're very serious about protecting our intellectual property. But I agree, it's a big mess for everybody.
I just think it's definitely going to be an interesting story to keep following as time goes on, for sure. But I just the mind boggles. I don't understand the motivation behind anyone for doing this. I mean, obviously you want to scoop people with a good story, but it just goes to show that you can push it slightly too far.
Well, I mean, Gizmodo's whole thing is this. Can you imagine the ad revenue?
Absolutely.
I'm sure they got multiples of their $5,000 investment back, but I think the unintended consequences of their choices are going to end up costing them much more dear.
All right. Well, I think we'll move on from there. Two weeks ago, we talked about the school district in Pennsylvania spying on one of their students. We talked about it before, but now it seems as if news legislation is going to be coming into play that will outlaw the covert monitoring of anybody via a camera. Eric, you brought this to our attention, so just wondering what you'd like to say about it, really.
Yeah, no, this is interesting because I was looking over the kind of the news stories this week to see what we should talk about. And one of the things that came up was there's a senator in Pennsylvania, Senator Arlen Specter, is proposing some sort of law, and I don't know what the text of it is going to be, that from the article I'm reading, it says making covert surveillance via camera illegal. And some of the quotes I've heard is it may add something onto the U.S. Federal Wiretap Act to protect people from this sort of intrusion. So I don't think it's going to be a blanket prohibition, but I'm wondering if it's going to extend some sort of reasonable expectation of privacy. And if you violate that reasonable expectation of privacy, now you're going to be running into problems at the federal level. And it's interesting because there's the civil suit going on. And if you go back and forth, you know, you see some of the motions. One of the interesting forensic angles, and one of the reasons why I think it's interesting, is the plaintiffs in this case, I think the parents of one of the students that were involved, they want to have one of the IT people's personal computers seized and examined. because there some emails that were discovered that said there were some IT people talking back and forth. And if you look at the motion to compel, there are some screenshots. They're talking about viewing the screenshots and the webcams. And one of the comments was, it's a little LMSD, which is the district soap opera. And the person who whose machine they want to forensicate responds, "I know, comma, I love it!" Exclamation point.
Oh, no.
So now the plaintiffs want to get immediately access to "I know, I love it's" person computer, so they can see if there's any evidence of downloading screenshots and webcam pictures on their personal computer, not just the district computer, which would be a huge mess, because now that would show that, you know, this IT people, not only were they misusing school resources, but hey, maybe they use their personal computer to log into, you know, whatever the software is involved in, and show it on their machine. So we'll see. I'll be curious to see if the court grants the request, and if so, what happens. And, you know, if I'm a police officer again, it's like, well, I'd want to know that, because let's say, you know, because the concern was, hey, there may be, you know, naked pictures of students on there, which is contraband. So it's like, well, was there contraband on this personal machine? Was it wiped? You know, it's the classic forensic questions, which is, you know, what was on the machine? What's the timeline? So, yeah, there's the two interesting things is, one, you know, there's the ever-present forensic angle. And then, two, there's, you know, federal legislative response being considered. So we'll see how it plays out. But this is another one of those ongoing stories that are interesting for forensic people.
Okay, so why did a new law need to be put in place for this? Is it not already covered by some existing legislation?
No, see, that's just it. I don't know. And Martin, I don't know. You seem to be very up on these things. Do you have any sense?
The sense I've got is it's covered under a lot of different things. I think what you need to remember is that Senator Spector is from Pennsylvania, where this school district is, and he's running in a really tough reelection campaign. So, I mean, this is raw American politics at play. This is the incessant thing you see. You know, a bad thing happens and local politician feels obliged to propose a new law, which may or may not ever happen. Now, do I think something like this needs to be covered under federal wiretap? Yeah, probably, especially when it has to do with minors. The question is, some of the language that was being floated out earlier, you know, potentially had implications for people who put cameras up in their business to watch, you know, for loss prevention. You know, are those covert? You know, do people have a reasonable expectation of privacy in the Squishy Mart? You know, while they're picking up a Snickers bar? I don't know. I have a tendency to think here in the United States we would say no, you don't. But it's just it's the classic. You know, we have to protect the children. We have to do something, and this semblance of calling a press conference to announce, you know, I'm going to do a new law. I would actually be shocked if it didn't happen. But I think, to me, the interesting part of this is I don't know if that motion to compel will ever actually be taken up, because I think this whole thing will be mooted. Because you got to think that the school district, after having been told by their insurance coverage company that this is not going to be covered, that the first thing they're going to desperately settle this out.
Make it go away.
And because there is nothing good that comes from this for the Lower Merion School District. What they need to do is settle this now and get people to sign non-disclosures to hopefully avoid law enforcement from coming in saying, all right, we do want to look at all 58,000 images to see if there are any contraband images. Yeah. And then, you know, the other just for me is, and this is the conversation I've been having with a couple of other folks, is, you know, if you look at this from just an IT perspective, you know, what this is the classic example of is technology that has a legitimate purpose. If you think about it, the school district had hundreds of these MacBook Pros, which is a chunk of change. I don't care who you are. It's a lot of money. Yeah. This was probably sold to the administrators as a way of protecting that investment. And, you know, if you put on your executive hat, that makes sense. The problem was that you gave a tool to a bunch of lower level folks, and there were apparently no controls at all. So you had low level folks who maybe just had too much free time on their hands, and they were able to trigger the system. And if they had been triggering it with good reasons and had the documentation and all, I think this would go away quickly. But the fact they didn't, and the fact that there just seemed to be, you know, a handful of folks who were using it for purposes it was never intended for, it has got the school district's you know, in this world of hurt.
I think it's quite interesting going back to what you said before about walking into a store and all that kind of stuff. I know that we're already disclaimed up the wazoo for, you know, all kinds of stuff. Now, I just wonder if now, whenever you walk into a store, there's going to be signs everywhere saying you're being monitored. If the security cameras, rather than being like set back in the corner, though out of the way, there's going to be a like big flashing light on them just to, just to show you that they're there and all that kind of stuff. So I think that brings up an interesting point anyway. So it's not very clear. Go on.
No, the other thing I was curious to find out is, or to see going over, the coming months, is how many schools, or if there will be any schools that have something like this already deployed that'll say, they're removing the software from their machines, or, the companies that offer this are going to be getting as many buyers, or, they're going to have to tailor their software to where it's tracking strictly by IP address, or some sort of LoJack type of thing without using a camera.
Well, the company that made the software does actually offer a solution that doesn't use the webcam. So, you have to ask the question: why did they go for that option in the first place? You got to really be very, very careful.
Well,
in this kind of situation,
to me, it's kind of obvious. I mean, if I look at it from the perspective of what they were trying to accomplish initially, being able to activate the webcam and see who stole the laptop or see physically where the laptop is located makes a lot of sense. There was actually this is probably 6-8 months ago, and I wish I could remember where I saw it, but there was a story going around where someone had installed this on their Mac, it got stolen, and they took pictures of the person and tracked the person down and got their stuff back. So it makes sense. It just got horribly, horribly misused.
One thing that I've thought quite a bit about in the last couple of weeks since we discussed this is, I don't know how many companies would use software like this, but can you imagine that, some IT guy somewhere went up to his bosses and said, "Here, we've got this monitoring software. It needs to be installed on all of the company computers that leave the office, just in case they get stolen." And I've just got this vision of this guy sitting alone in his home at night, logging into, a secretary's laptop or whatever, while she's using it at home. And I can understand the software being deployed and it being of a valuable use, but there's so much potential for misuse with this. Surely it can't be good.
What could possibly go wrong?
Would you bet a ton of money that isn't actually happening somewhere in the world right now?
Say that again, sorry.
Would you bet that scenario that you drew out isn't actually happening in some Fortune 100 environment right now?
Oh, no.
I'm not placing any bets against that at all, no.
Well, how many companies have, the cameras all around their office buildings and stuff that they can remote into? I mean, the place I work, my boss can, be wherever and remote in and look at the cameras in her office and see what's going on.
But that is the cameras inside the office. If you've got people taking a computer home from the office and, you think, well, she's quite hot, I'll see what she's doing on her computer, and all of a sudden you see that her computer's been left on in her bedroom or something like that, and it gets really, really bad from that point forward for whoever gets involved in that.
Well, and I'm sure the way this all started was it was just an extension of that.
Yeah.
So, Lee, should we be worried that you put this much thought into it?
I've got to keep tabs on my wife when I'm at work, No, but that's what I'm saying, though. It's just that there is so much potential for misuse with this. I mean, over here in the UK and in Germany and all that, there's the strict regulations on hacking tools. Like, if you get caught in possession of them, you can get into a serious amount of trouble. But it's just, I think this kind of software should be regulated in a similar way.
Because I think here in the U.S., it's less about the tool itself than what you do with it. I think there's a totally different thought between European and American thoughts on stuff. And in Europe, it seems to me, and it's not just software, but across a whole lot of items, where if the item could conceivably be used for bad, it's much more likely to be regulated, controlled, and proscribed than here in the United States, where it's more about, generally speaking, you could have the item, you can use the item, but until you cross a line of demarcation, you're okay. But once you cross that line of demarcation, you get the React team kicking in your door and taking all your That's what I think. It's less about the Europeans do it right and the Americans or the Americans do it. It's just two totally different cultural philosophies on life.
I think it's also the reality is in terms of the political situation, in terms of who's controlling those sorts of law. I think the U.S. is still very corporate friendly in terms of how things get done, whereas I don't know if in the U.K. that happens as often.
Hmm. No, I think that's a fair point. Very fair. All right. Another thing which has been catching the eyes and imaginations of digital forensic investigators around the globe recently is this whole thing that CBS attempted to uncover with digital photocopiers a few days ago. And what they did is that they set up an investigation to go out and they bought like 4 used photocopy machines, took them back to their offices, had someone take out the hard drives out of the photocopy machines, which I'm going to hold my hand up and say I had no idea that modern photocopiers had hard drives. I'm now quite worried about some of the Christmas parties I've been to. But they found that these hard drives contained some very, very sensitive documents. Some from a police, like sexual crimes unit, one from a construction company, one from a doctor's office. And so the stuff they were pulling out was potentially very, very damaging to these people. I have to say, I'd not even considered the idea of performing forensics on a photocopier before. Never even crossed my mind.
What kind of cracked me up about this story when it first came out is, for those of you that don't know, I was a victim of the economy twice over the last 2 years. And during one of my little in-between jobs types of scenarios, I was taking a lot of classes at Guidance. And at one of the classes, I don't remember what happened, but they had a photocopier in their training room. And they were talking something about, somehow it came up that there was a hard drive in the copier. And I actually said to the training instructor, I'm like, "Did you ever try imaging it?" And he was actually afraid to, because there's a camera in the office building looking straight down at the copier, so they didn't want to really be ripping apart a rented copier to image it. But this is about 2 years ago that I was actually thinking that, and it's the whole thing that I'm sure all of us feel like, as soon as you find out something has a memory card or a hard drive in it or something, it's like, okay, how can I plug it into a write blocker and image it? So it's kind of funny the amount of noise this is getting, and I think what's this is going to kind of turn into is the whole buying hard drives on eBay type of thing. Now there's something else that we suddenly discover has a hard drive in it, which has been there for the years, and all this stuff's on it.
Yeah, this is interesting because I've actually done some forensicating on copiers before. About 6 months ago, somebody brought me one, a disc. It was like a SCSI disc off of an old copier that we were getting rid of, and asked me, well, hey, we think there might be something on there. Can you take a look at it? So I'm like, great. I'm the type of guy, like I said before, I buy a dishwasher. I want to figure out how to take stuff off it. Well, sure enough, it was pulling stuff off it. So it's for forensic people. It's like, hey, here's another thing to consider. If you're a police officer, you do a search warrant, nothing else, something else to grab. And for those of us who have these in our office, you got to remember, give it, if you're going to give this stuff away or get rid of it, do what I call lovingly the Jimi Hendrix treatment, which is what I do with computers before I give them away. Let it play. You have it play an MP3 of the national anthem. You douse it with lighter fluid and you set it on fire. And in this case, the lighter fluid and the fire is like the deep band nuke disk. So, if it's a hard drive, something's going to land on it. And if something's going to land on it, then there's people like us. Our job is to pull stuff off it. So, yeah, it's great. And this was the eBay reference is a good one, because this one is particularly horrifying in that. It was the Buffalo, New York Police Department that had some of their information was on it. Targets from a major drug raid. Apparently, there were information, like you said, on sex crimes. There was like pay stubs from a construction company, and there was stuff from a health plan that had like medical records and drug prescriptions and blood test results. So it's really, I assume there's some egregious violation of HIPAA or something going on there. So it's a wake up call for everybody, both for forensicators that, hey, here's more stuff that we can play with and get information off. And for, just security practitioners, well, it's time to educate people to, get these things properly processed before they leave your control.
I just wonder. I mean, personally, I'd never heard of a hard drive being in a photocopy until I actually read this story. No clue whatsoever. How many people before, up until just recently, just out of you three guys here, actually knew this was the case?
I did. I've actually been aware with it for a while, but it's little known.
Here's what I want to know: when is it going to become discoverable?
Oh yeah, for e-discovery. I mean, there's all sorts of interesting aspects for e-discovery now. When is e-discovery going to start hitting mobile phones? So now it's going to hit copiers. Why wouldn't you hit copiers if you thought there was some smoking gun over mobile? It has. E-discovery has. Great. Well,
yeah, I've seen discovery requests that include mobile phones already. So that's a given. But I think the point of including photocopiers, you could make the argument, because some of these e-discovery requests are so extraordinarily broad that they're already included, right? Because most of the discovery right. requests say things under your control. To me, I think what's ended up happening is if people start taking this seriously, and I'm actually interested to see what the government does about this, and I'm assuming a lot of the Fortune 100 will follow whatever path the U.S. government takes. Are we going to start saying, okay, the hard drives are going to be encrypted on these devices? Are we going to say that, just like, I think you're mentioning, when you pull a server or a workstation out, as it goes out for reclamation, is part of the control going to be the hard drive comes out and gets, slagged, shredded, drilled, burned, what have you, before it goes out to for recycling? I think in the end, we'll end up treating these just like servers, just like laptops, just like workstations, because in the end, if we're honest about it, that's what they are. They're plugged into your network. They have IP addresses. They're usually running some version of Linux, and they've got 50, 70, 80 gig hard drives on them. How is that different than a lot of the other stuff that we just plug into our network?
Yeah. Well, one of the things that after reading this story and watching the accompanying video on the CBS News website, I thought that I would have a bit of a dig around and see what the information that there lies out there about this. And apparently, this, it's a decent story, don't get me wrong, but there may have been over-egging it ever so slightly. As a lot of companies now, they are coming out and they're saying, well, we already have security features in place. These are old photocopiers, or they're photocopies from another manufacturer. They wouldn't be able to do this without us because the disks are either encrypted or they've got specific locks on the drives or any number of different things that they all, and some of them even have like a disk wiping mechanism built into the photocopier itself. So I don't think it's really necessary for us to all run out all of a sudden and start pulling out the hard drives out of photocopiers and wiping them. But as they said in this article, this has been going on photocopies have had hard drives included in them since around about 2002. Now, at what point were these security measures put in place? And, you know, how many people actually have the brand new ones with those measures in place, and how many people and companies actually still use the old photocopiers? Because I'm pretty sure that the old, you know, that these law enforcement organizations, they don't have the budget to go out and buy new photocopiers every couple of years. They're probably still using the same one that they bought back in 2002, 2003, or and so on.
I'm willing to bet my sheriff's department still uses mimeograph machines.
The one thing I would be curious about is how many people that are getting these copiers in have even thought of that, to even ask the question.
No,
you know, exactly. So what happens to this copier? Because I think probably part of it is that it's, you know, just what you've been used to for so long. You make a copy, it spits the copy out, and you put the paper away or what have you. It's not storing that information. But as you start looking at the multi-purpose printers, where, you know, anyone sitting in your office can send a print job or a copy job or an email job through the printer, or you put a scan into the printer and email it off to somebody, that's all got to be stored somewhere. And it's like, oh, look at all the, you know, bells and whistles this copier has, but not the fact of, well, wait a minute, what happens when this lease is up and we give it back to you? What do you guys do?
It's scary. It certainly is scary. But I just, one of the things which I thought was quite funny is I brought this story up at work, and someone said, well, you know, what I hate to think of how many pictures of my backside and my genitals happen to be floating around on various photocopiers around the world now.
I think we're going to start seeing a very big run of imaging hard drives from photocopiers after the company Christmas parties.
It's a fascinating story, and it's after talking to people at work about it, we've decided that we want to try and get hold of a couple of old photocopiers off eBay and possibly do some small investigations on them and see what we can find, maybe write a paper about it.
Security research. It's a wonderful thing.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. It'll be my next big thing after volume shadow copies. So, but yeah. I think it's a wicked, wicked story. And if no one's ever, if no one's seen it yet, CBSnews.com, they've got the article there. They've also got a video you can watch. In the grand scheme of things, I mean, these kind of things will effectively lead to identity theft. But at the end of the day, you know, who cares about identity theft? Because privacy is obviously over, isn't it?
It's certainly being challenged.
It's being challenged, but this is actually the story I've been most interested in talking about, because I had an offline conversation with some friends, and I actually believe privacy is actually getting stronger over the last 12, 18 months. And I think we have Facebook to thank for that. Because if you think about it, Facebook is sort of the icon of taking your privacy away or restating the privacy rules, and people are finally paying attention. But I think what this article does that you sent me, Lee, was I think the problem is people are conflating privacy and transparency. You know, for those people who are north of 40 years old like me, we look at some of these 20-somethings and go, why in the world are you using things like Twitter, or, you know, the conversation I had with Andy recently, you know, if you've ever heard of Blippi, where you essentially create a stream of showing where you spent money on your credit card. Why?
Very dangerous.
Why in the world would you do that? And I think some of the younger folks I talked to, you know, they are open to having their lives be much more transparent. They understand that, and they're willing to share a lot more information, and that's transparency. But they're actually becoming much more concerned with who has visibility to it, and that's to me the privacy side. So I'm actually feeling better about privacy now than I was a year ago, because as people have becoming more transparent and there's been the inevitable abuses of it, people are understanding it and taking I think the steps they need to protect their privacy while they get to maintain their transparency.
Yeah, and the interesting thing about the social networking, you know, the increased use of it is because the model is from Facebook and a lot of these other social networks that the people who use, let's say, Facebook, you're not really Facebook's customer. You're a commodity. It's your data, really, that they want. That's their business model. And for forensicators, this is great because, well, you have to use a computer or you have to use a mobile device to access this stuff. So this puts stuff into our sphere, where for our investigations, now we have a lot more artifacts that we can look for. It makes memory forensics, even for, you know, memory forensics really, when it started out, was, you know, it seemed like everyone was interested in it if they were in incident response because of malware and that sort of thing. But it's important to understand, and I know Rob Lee's been making this point, that, you know, for every forensicator now, you know, there's interesting stuff in memory that may come from social media or stuff on the hard drives. So it's interesting from the forensics aspect. We're going to be along for the ride, and it'll be interesting to see how this turns out and how people respond to it.
I do like that point you made earlier. That was one thing that I was going to raise myself, that, you know, we aren't the customers for Facebook and, you know, MySpace and whoever else anymore. We're the information. We're
the product.
We're the things which they trade in.
Yeah, the Harmony guy, the one that we're, the article we're talking about is, there's a blog out there, a fellow called, it's called Social Hacking by the Harmony guy, and you can follow him on Twitter. And he wrote a blog on April 26th, a blog post that says, why I care if others care about what they ate for breakfast. And he talks about, you know, essentially how it's really hard to avoid social networking. Yeah, you can, you know, go off the grid, so to speak, but, you know, there may be personal and then professional consequences. So, and then he kind of talks about what we've talked about, which is, hey, you know, we're not the customers, you know, we're the products. And you know, the question is, you know, who is Facebook's customers? And I'm thinking, I think it's the ad providers, because who's Absolutely. Giving them money? So I would think it would be the ad providers and Google and the other people who they have a business relationship with. We certainly aren't the customers.
Just as a side note, I do find it quite funny. I get invited to groups on Facebook quite frequently, where people are like, Facebook are going to start charging users for using Facebook.
No, they're not. No,
they're never going to do that.
No, they're not.
Kill off the entire company.
Absolutely not.
So stop inviting me to these groups. I hate them. But I just, I don't know what. One of the things which I've seen happen quite a lot, is that people will go on and they'll post things which they're not necessarily controversial, but they're certainly interesting pictures or interesting experiences. And if they leave their Facebook profiles open, you know, they might go to a job interview or something like that, and a potential employer, before even setting eye on this person, can know so much information about them. And why? Why would you do it? Why would you put that much information about yourself on the internet to start with? And second of all, why aren't you doing anything to protect yourself from, you know, making stupid mistakes?
Well, I think it comes down to those who are digital immigrants. I mean, you know, growing up, when I grew up, I actually, you know, I distinctly remember the first time I was able to connect to the internet. I compare that to my kids who are digital natives. You know, the internet has always been there for them, you know, and that really came clear to me. We were on a vacation one time in the desert southwest of the U.S., and my son said, well, Dad, I need to get on the internet. And it was, you can't do that from here. And he looked at me, deadpan, absolutely serious, Dad, the internet is everywhere. So, and that's their worldview.
Yeah.
So for them, it makes perfect sense to do all this, just like you might create a scrapbook with you know, pictures from college or the bachelor party or whatever. You know, you have it in a scrapbook that sits on, you know, maybe in a box in your attic or on a shelf in your living room. They're putting it on Flickr, and I think there's almost no difference in the digital native's mind between the two. at all.
Tom, were you going to say something?
Well, personally, I don't have a Facebook account, and my wife and I have been thinking about doing it because of a lot of my family and her family, more of my family than hers, are using it. And it's like whenever Facebook kind of pushes out their little privacy things, I kind of remember why I don't have one yet. But the one thing I always think about with these social networks anymore is how much of it is the perceived online anonymity that used to be out there, that it's not really as much out there anymore. And what I mean by that is how many people would share the same sorts of things to complete strangers when you're walking down the street versus posting it on your wall on Facebook or something like that. I do agree with Martin's point in terms of how we've grown up. Just seeing these sorts of things explode literally in the last, 5 years? I mean, how many years ago was Facebook strictly something for university students?
Yeah, not that long ago.
Right. And, you know, I'm starting to see my kids do the same thing that Martin was talking about, but my kids are younger in that, you know, my son is already in first grade having to learn how to type on a computer keyboard. I don't think I touched a computer keyboard till I was 7, and much less in school, probably not until, you know, 6th or 7th grade. And I think that that perception of all that information that's out there is partially what's driving it from the human perspective, in that a lot of it stems from your 15 minutes of fame, so to speak. You know, you sort of have this own little world that you can feel important, which, you know, a lot of people like to do that. And there's sort of this, hey, here I am, this is what I'm doing, isn't this type of interesting? And it may be interesting to you, and it may be interesting to other people. But I don't think the conception of the reach that it has at this point is completely ingrained.
I did think about something else as well when, I do think about this quite frequently, actually, about the stuff that I post online. And previously, I was a contractor at Zentech and at Cyfor for police work. And I can imagine that somebody who has gone to prison or has been, had some kind of legal proceeding against them because of something that I've found on their computer, just looking at the report, seeing my name on the report, and thinking, right, I'm going to see what I can find out about this person. Going online, you know, logging into Facebook or something else, looking for me, and bang, there I am. And all of a sudden, they have all this information about me. And if they've got retribution on their mind, this is where I think this whole privacy argument is very, very dicey. Because if you've got people who don't like you, or if people who are stalking you, this whole claim to privacy being dead, it's very, very dangerous.
Well, the geolocation technology is very interesting too, because especially for stalking, I don't think people necessarily understand how much geolocation goes on. Like with Twitter, anytime I go on Twitter's webpage, it's always bugging me to enable geolocation. So if somebody wants to stalk me with geolocation, you know, I tweet, you know, hey, you know, how things are going. Well, you know where I am. A pretty good ballpark idea where I am. So yeah, there's a lot that I don't think people realize that's being kept on them. I mean, I wonder how many people understand how trackable your cell phones are. Probably not that many.
And it's not even that. I mean, how many people play Foursquare?
Oh yeah, the robbery game. Yeah, or the burglary game. Yeah.
Well, I would hesitate to call that because I'm something of a fan of Foursquare. But I mean, for example, I would never check in at my house. You know, I don't check in at work because where the physical location of where I work is really none of your business. Now, if you're interested in the fact that my kids and I like to go to CC's Pizza, or you know, I spend an inordinate amount of money at my local Starbucks, well, you know, you just have to be around me for 10 minutes to know my predilection for coffee and good pizza. So, again, I think it's you know, I think your point of people maybe don't understand the reach of it, and they're not maybe using it as wisely as they should. But again, if you're an old fart like me, I look back to when I was in my teens and 20s, and there were equally rash and unwise decisions I was making about the new technology in the world then. So I think this is, you know, it's the same thing, just happening faster, and I think its reach is a lot greater than we've probably ever seen.
You can make more damaging decisions now quicker than when I was growing up, but it's still a lot of the same decisions.
So, do we agree then? Do we think that privacy is possibly a thing of the past, or do we think that? Martin made a good point saying that he thought that privacy, I think it was Martin who said privacy is actually getting stronger.
Yeah, I think it is.
I don't share Martin's optimism, but I'm an eternal pessimist. I think privacy is on death's door knocking loudly.
I think the awareness of it is more of, there's an increased awareness of it because of the liberty that's out there with the information you put out. So that people think about it maybe, or, you know, they have their one little bloop where, you know, maybe I shouldn't have posted that tweet. You know, there's sites like, what is it? Texting While Intoxicated, or
oh, no.
My Life. I mean, yeah, there's sites out here, and you look at this stuff and you kind of, I mean, at least for me, you start to kind of reminisce and remember, say, the things you see, and I'm not going to admit if I participated or not, and, you know, and stuff, and you were in college or in high school and stuff, and you see what people are putting on these types of sites, and it's like, would I have ever even thought to do that had this sort of technology been around? And it gets kind of frightening to think of sort of what can come back to haunt you, because probably for most of us, it would be more of what a person said, or say a picture that might have been taken on a Polaroid camera, or, you know, one of those little Kodak disc cameras or something like that when we were growing up. Now it's, you know, you snap a cell phone picture and it's on three different websites within a matter of minutes, and there's nothing you can do about it.
I think about whenever you look at like election campaigns and stuff, which we'd already kind of touched on a bit earlier, where, you know, a small fragment of information from someone's past can come back to really bite them in the bum, like years, years and years later on. Are we going to start seeing this a lot more with things like Facebook and stuff, where, you know, say, you know, an 18-year-old, 19-year-old goes out drinking in the States under the legal drinking age, you know, it's photographed drinking alcohol some years down the line when they're running for public office. Is it going to say, hey, look, well, on Facebook, you posted these pictures years and years and years ago. Is it going to get to that extent?
You will see that. I mean, look at the media culture right now when it comes to celebrities. I mean, anything that they go, people go going around and finding stuff to post on them. So for politicians, absolutely, because not only will you have the media outlets looking for this, you're going to have the operation research. I mean, it gets back to, you know, this is meat on our table for forensicators, but it's also meat on the table for people who do political opposition research. So, yeah, you're absolutely going to see this stuff.
And I think with a lot of that, the bigger fear is not necessarily what you are posting; it's what someone else that's with you is posting. That now you have no control over that.
Very true.
Well, yeah, there's stuff that. Oh, go ahead, Martin.
But I think what we're talking about is not that this is something brand new that's happened, especially in you know, for celebrities and politicians. You know, people who are public persons. This has been going. I mean, I am sure that, you know, people followed Thomas Jefferson around, writing down the things he said and who he was visiting. I mean, is it happening faster, cheaper, better? Yeah. But I think partly what bothers me is, and not in this conversation, but, you know, in other conversations we've all experienced, there are people who are acting like this is the first time in the history of mankind that it's not. I mean, I remember getting lectured from my parents around having a numeric pager, right? you know, in Boys and Girls, there used to be these little boxes that people carried on their hips where you could actually send a phone number to someone or little code messages in there. And it did happen. I can tell someone else got those lectures too. So I think part of it is, you know, one, as a parent, I'm trying to educate my kids on what they should and shouldn't do. And it's just going to happen. I'll go so far as to say I'm willing to bet that people had these conversations around the table when the telegraph first went in. You know, you're going to send this telegram to someone. Look at all the people who are going to read your message on the. I think everyone just needs to sit back and take a deep breath and relax.
It's certainly a higher velocity culture, and it's funny because Mart and I apparently we grew up with the same vacuum tube technology, and it's like Martin says, to get back to your point about politicians. I mean, dirty politics isn't anything new, but now there's more tools for the dirty politicians and their operatives to use against each other. So nothing is new under the sun. It's just we have maybe quicker ways and more efficient ways of doing what we've already done before.
And I think a lot of the stigma associated is going to go away. I mean, 5 years ago, if there was a picture of you with a beer in your hand on Facebook, that could potentially disqualify you from even an entry-level job. These days, especially in my previous gig, if you were coming to work for me and you didn't have a Facebook profile or anything like that, I'd be wondering what was wrong with you. And if there was the picture of you with a red Solo cup in your hand, okay, youthful indiscretion, but it wasn't the immediate job killer that it may have been 5, 6, 7 years ago. And I think as the culture becomes more used to the context that a lot of these photos live in, we're going to start dealing with it. And I think, the ability to withstand that sort of indiscretion will move higher and higher in the job chain till at some point in 20 or 30 years when the university students of today are, managing directors and VPs, the stigma will have been minimized to the point where it's like, if someone had a Polaroid picture of me, and I'll deny that there are any, of me in high school drinking, it'll be like that. There'll be the little laugh about it and we'll move on.
I remember a few months ago that there was some city office or something in the US that was demanding that people turn over their Facebook credentials for the possible employer at the city to have a look at them and make sure they hadn't been up to anything mischievous. Now, is that an acceptable request? Or, because that kind of falls in line with all this, but with a little bit of added something, because whereas before you could protect your goings on by locking people out or setting certain privacy settings and whatnot, if they have your credentials to get in and to actually see what you've been doing completely, then how does that change things?
Wow. My brain is still trying to get around someone saying you have to give me your personal Facebook credential.
Yeah, that's not going to happen.
That'd be a really interesting conversation to have, because my thing would be, let's say this was a job I had to keep. It'd be, I don't have a Facebook account, and I would immediately go home and kill my Facebook account. And I think, as the culture matures and as employers begin to realize, hey, I don't need to get your credentials to see what you've done on Facebook, I think it's become less and less of an issue. That being said, there are chuckleheads everywhere who ask for that kind of stuff.
And some of it. Oh, sorry, Martin, I didn't mean to interrupt. Go ahead.
No, go right ahead.
I come from a law enforcement background. So if for a private employer to ask me that, well, no, go pound sand. But for law enforcement, their background investigations, having gone through several, are pretty intense and they're pretty comprehensive. So what I'm curious is, because I went to school to be a police officer. I actually had a degree in law enforcement, and this is what I wanted to do. If I wanted to be a police officer, and a lot of police departments made the decision that, they want to do social networking investigations as part of that background investigation, you know, I'd have to make a decision. You know, if there's this department I really want to work for, am I going to subject myself to that? Well, probably. And maybe that's one of those things that you need to understand, you know, early if you've picked your career, that, hey, there's going to be consequences that because you're applying for, let's say, a very secret government job or a law enforcement job, you will have to give up some of your reasonable expectations of privacy and understand that the background investigations are going to be fairly intensive and you may have to submit to this. Therefore, you know, maybe you don't post as much stuff.
I don't know if any of you guys heard the story about what happened over here a couple of months back, where I can't remember if it was the head of the MI5 or something like that had been on vacation somewhere and his wife had taken some pictures of him and posted them online on her Facebook. And it caused a massive furore over here. It was just, people just were like, oh, well, you know, that's just blown loads of secrecy stuff out of the water and everything else. But once again, you know, kind of overreacting a bit, because who cares about seeing someone working for MI5 wearing his swim shorts standing on a beach somewhere? What is that going to tell you about him? I just thought it was bizarre. But anyway, certainly this whole privacy thing is certainly very, very interesting. And I know that Facebook have been declaring that privacy is dead for quite a while, up until the point where, what's his name? The guy who runs Facebook.
Zuckerman?
Sorry?
Is it Zuckerman?
Yeah, Zuckerberg. Mark Zuckerberg. Up until the point where Mark Zuckerberg accidentally posted all of his personal photographs on public so everybody could see them. So, it's interesting. Certainly an interesting thing. Okay, so, alright, well, I think I've talked about everything that I want to talk about so far. Have you guys got anything you want to bring up?
Nothing here.
I do actually. Okay. I was kind of curious on everyone's opinion on the there's a Sans blog about the presenters from .con that demonstrated the exploit in the disk image on FTK and Ncase.
Oh, I haven't read this yet.
It was, when was it posted? On the 27th, John McCash had posted it. And
arbitrary code execution on examiner systems via file format vulnerabilities.
Yeah. I was kind of curious to your all opinions on it. One aspect is I'm surprised that this hasn't happened sooner, but how is this different than the usual risks that we as examiners can have in examining these sorts of things, from mounting an image to do any sort of examination on it?
Well, I'm going to step out on a limb and say I think this will present an equivalent level of threat that DCAF has, and just leave it at that.
Yeah, no, I would tend to agree. It's like, okay, fine, you found, let's say, an exploit in Ncase, where if an examiner tries to open a particular file, it does a buffer overflow or whatever. Okay, fine. You just knocked over my air-gapped machine. I don't know what that gets you. But yeah, it's like the DCAF, and I'll point out, I haven't seen Timestomp used yet. Vinnie Liu created some really great anti-forensic tools, and I think they are a Metasploit module now, but you know, I've never run across anything like that. The most anti-forensics tools I've run across in my investigations were wiping tools, and in general, even that's fairly crudely done and just points out that, okay, well, I know which machine I have to look at more carefully. So it's interesting, but I think I'm with Martin on this.
Yeah, it's a great philosophical exercise, and I think from just a geek fanboy perspective, it's pretty cool and it's got all the hotness. But really, is the adversary going to use it? Well, no. if you've got an adversary who's technically capable of doing that. There's other stuff they're going to do to protect themselves, like, oh, I don't know, use BitLocker. So it's interesting, and it may lead to other things, but I just don't see it becoming the problem that some people might think it would.
The Chinese have other things they're working on that, rather than trying to knock over an exploit on a forensic examiner's machine, they're more concerned with taking their stuff.
Yeah, you meant advanced persistent threat. You didn't mean Chinese.
Yeah, I'm sorry. Yeah, sorry.
Well, I'm quite interested to see if any kind of proof of concept arises from this, because I mean it's one thing to stop somebody being able to analyze your machine, but it's another thing that if you know opening one of these disk images, say for you know an NCASE or FTK, to then suddenly you know this is arbitrary code execution. They could basically do whatever they want to your computer. You know, obviously, if you're on an isolated network, it's not going to have as much of an effect. But yeah, I agree with you. Don't get me wrong, but it's a bit more than just stopping somebody analyzing your machine. This is an attack specifically targeted at somebody who's going to look at your computer somewhere down the line. So you may have something like BitLocker in place, but you also may have a dumb computer which sits in the corner that never gets used, which you've already preloaded with all this fun stuff on, that you know if you ever get caught, that's going to get analyzed as well, and it could do some damage somewhere down the line.
Okay, but here, look at it this way. All right, so I am an advanced persistent threat. I've got multiple machines in my Cavern of Doom. Johnny Law shows up and grabs all my stuff. Now, my five machines where I've actually got billions and billions of credit card numbers and the plans to the Joint Strike Fighter, you know, I've got BitLocker. So Johnny Law is completely out of luck. So I'm going to have that one, my old Pentium 90 sitting there with this loaded on it to smack his air-gapped, you know, analyst machine. Okay, this is the functional equivalent, and I'm going to use, because I am from the Southern Fried Security Podcast, a somewhat culturally appropriate illusion. This is walking up to the Georgia State Trooper whose radar wasn't working right and he has no way of writing you a ticket, and then urinating on his car tire. Why in the world, if I'm an advanced persistent threat and I'm capable of doing all this stuff, would I go out of my way to piss law enforcement off? I'm not going to do it. So again, it's a whole thing of who's going to use it. And if they're dumb enough to use it, they're going to get caught by Johnny Law doing other stuff anyway. So, again, it's a great academic exercise, but like a Gilbert and Sullivan musical, it's not going to signify very much.
Fair enough. I'll consider myself told now.
I'd like to point out that Martin managed to do a Gilbert and Sullivan reference and throw in the Georgia State Patrol. I am impressed.
And actually, if I could simply get someone to say the word cloud computing, I get bingo four corners.
Oh, fun stuff. All right. Well, unless anyone else has got anything to talk about, I think we'll wrap it up there. No? Going once. All right. I think we're done. So, just leaves me to say thank you to everybody for coming back and for Martin for being on here for the first time.
Oh, like I said before, thanks for the invitation. I really, really appreciate it.
No problem. Like I said before, Martin is one of the co-hosts for Southern Fried Security. Good podcast, well worth listening to. Do you want to give out your Twitter account?
Absolutely. Name on here? You can subscribe to the podcast at www.southernfriedsecurity.com. You can follow the podcast feed at SFS Podcast. You can follow me. I'm Armor Guy on Twitter. And while I tweet a lot of things, some of it's security, some of it's not. And so I hope to hear from some of the forecast listeners. It'd be great to hear from you.
Cool stuff. And also, Tom, CDT Delta on Twitter, is that right?
That's correct.
Yeah, big fan of Delta Airlines, obviously.
Yeah, no.
Right, and Eric Huber, he's got his Fistful of Dongles blog, which is progressing quite nicely. Where can we find that, Eric?
Yeah, you can find that Eric J. Huber, H-U-B-E-R, at blogspot.com, and I'm also on Twitter, Eric J. Huber, also there. I protect my tweets because I'm got tired of all the bots, but you know, as long as you look human, I accept the request very quickly.
Yeah, I this week I actually took my tweet stream off protected. I did it purposely a few months ago in order to protect myself against some goings on, and those events have now expired, so there's no point in doing that anymore. So feel free to tweet bot me as much as you want. All right, yep, I can be found on Twitter at Schizofroid, or you can follow the Forensic Forecast podcast at Forecast. You have no idea how many weather channels want that Twitter name, but we'll leave that for another time. Thanks, everyone, once again for being on. It's fun, as always, and we'll catch you next time. Bye for now.